Mr. Record Man. I'm looking for a song I heard today. It's time for the Saftercast. I'm your host, Scatsy. Hey ho, how you doing? Are you doing good? Is today a good day for you? If it is a good day, then we will endeavor to keep that good mood going. And if it's not a good day, allow us to hit our coffee cup spoon and hopefully turn your day around. Welcome to the Saftercast. Episode 38 is here right now with the one and the only Jim Warner as our guest. Before we get onto that interview and talking about it, some information of upcoming events, reminders for you from the Sundress Academy for the Arts. First and foremost, this coming weekend on Saturday, this 26th of September from 1 to 4 p.m., get your fall haunting season on with a nice little workshop program put on by the Sundress Academy for the Arts. Strange Passengers, Writing the Urban Legend and Ghost Story. It's going to be an interesting one. Maybe you know some ghost stories, and maybe you know some urban legends, and I'm not just talking about the one that you're thinking of. No, I'm thinking of other ones as well. The workshop takes place with the one and the only Emily Capitini leading the whole shebang, and that is this Saturday, as I said, from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Sundress Academy for the Arts in Knoxville, Tennessee, just on the outskirts of it at Firefly Farms. For full information about this, you can check out sundressacademyforthearts.com or sundresspublications.com. Click on the store or click on SAFTA to learn more and to purchase tickets. Along those lines, another thing you can purchase a ticket for, October 16th through the 18th. I'm bringing it up again. Why? Because I believe in it and it is such a great event. The 2015 Fall Nonfiction Writing Retreat is taking place at the Sundress Academy out in the camping grounds of the Firefly Farms location. Sarah Einstein, T.A. Noonan, both guests on this program. You can check out our episodes to get to know them a little bit better, but you can also get to know them at the retreat. They'll be leading this retreat talking about the big issues that plague nonfiction and also how to increase your abilities about it. It is a weekend camping retreat. It is truly a fantastic event. I cannot believe it's happening because it is so amazing, and just the guest load is amazing already. I can tell you that right now. The people who are in on it, oh, it's going to be good. You want to get in on this, I know you do, but space is limited. To get your tickets now, go on, as I said, to sundressacademyforthearts.com. You can buy directly from there, or you can go to sundresspublications.com. Click on store, and it will take you there as well, and you can find it there. That is the 2015 Fall Nonfiction Writing Retreat, October 16th through the 18th, 2015. Coming your way soon, and coming your way right now. We try to endeavor on this episode. What happens when you put two music fans, two music nerds together on the same podcast? Well, it is an interesting one as we debate and discuss between Jim and I. What are the litmus tests that we have for our friends? You know, the test if we're going to be friends with somebody. You know, you go into somebody's house, you judge their record collection. Well, are there certain tracks, certain albums, certain genres you use to test if that friend is going to become a good friend of yours or not? But we also discuss many things such as our first albums, some of the crown jewels in our record libraries, and much, much more. And don't forget, this coming Monday, Jim's new podcast, Citizen Lit, drops. You can find all the information at citizenlitcast.com. You can preview the trailers there. The first episode drops this coming Monday, the 28th of September. But right now, I'm going to drop a little bit of Sonics for your ear with the taste of our theme song. By my guests.
Oh yeah, no problem, man. It's cool.
It's all good. Anyway, Jim, thanks for coming on the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, Scott. I look forward to making this connection and being on the program since we talked at AWP.
Yeah, it was kind of our first, I think our first real meeting each other, although I'd heard your name on my end a few times floating around.
Likewise, I checked out the SAFTA cast, and you know, obviously I know I know you're a significant other. Yeah, so, yeah, thank you very much for having me on.
Thanks for being here, man. Yeah, we don't really talk about my significant other in the sense of, like, we love keeping it kind of a mystery so that other writers come to us and are like, holy shit, you're married to her? Or vice versa? It's like, yeah.
That's pretty much the thought I had. I was like, oh, shit, wow, okay, oh, cool, all right. That's cool, they're married, all right. You know, it's kind of, it's nice to have that kind, you know, that autonomy, I think. You know, Aubrey and I have been dating for about a year, a little over a year now. And sometimes I go back and forth about that too, especially since, you know, we're both writers. We both have our kind of our thing. And, you know, you don't want necessarily to be pegged one way or the other, like, oh, you're with her, she's with you. And, you know, the really weird relationship, writing life questions that kind of come up sometimes. And yeah, it's interesting. So, but that's cool, man. I'm, you know, it was cool to meet you briefly. I look forward to actually hanging with you a little longer since we're now in SAFTA territory down here in Knoxville. So fully indoctrinated. You know, last week we were in Memphis repping Sundress and yeah, just hanging out in workshops, been out to the farm, you know, so yeah, full in.
Well, you'll see a bit more of me then, I'm sure, as I come up, and my significant other will be there in October. But with you and your girlfriend Aubrey, do you have the same? Do you have similar styles of writing, or are you very different from each other in terms of what you do?
We are. I think that there's enough difference between our styles. When we first started dating, you know, Aubrey writes a lot of haiku and a lot of haibun, besides flash fiction and things like that. You know, she's probably influenced me more than her. I she'd probably say otherwise, but you know, she turned me on to like haibun and writing in these forms, and you know, really kicked my ass as far as my own writing and my own writing style. I always thought that I was kind of brief and was, you know, was exacting with images and stuff, and she told me otherwise or showed me otherwise. I think I'm a little more pop culture with her. I'm a little more, you know, basically I'm kind of like a two or three trick pony. It's like, I'm Asian, I like records, I travel, and I'm alone. That's pretty much all I write about, and she has a little broader palette than that. So
I always wonder, because my wife and I are very, very different in our stylistic approach. Very different. Not polar opposites, but very different. So I think it would be hard, really, to be with someone who's in not only the same genre, but same school of genre than you.
You know, it is, but it isn't. I think that, you know, there are things about each of our writing that are different. I mean, she writes flash fiction. I don't write flash at all. And, you know, we're pretty laid back. You know, she's been great for my writing. I'd hope she would say the same. And also, because I come from, you know, a performance and a slam background, you know, I've been able to kind of help her out with the performance dynamics for her readings. And yeah, it's been pretty beneficial. And I think it's because we're both fairly ego-free and we're both really interested in writing as a community. So, you know, the ability to write together, you know, not necessarily write together, but to workshop together. And also, both since we're both editors, you know, we both have run the magazines. We both have had, you know, we send work out. We're working, you know, in that field. I think we both get it in that way too. That it isn't really competitive. So yeah, it's really been nice. It's a change of pace.
From past relationships where you've not dated writers?
Well, from past relationships where I have dated writers.
Oh, okay.
And you know, it's they've been poets, and it hasn't been that. It has been more competitive and definitely, you know, weird, you know, your weird relationship dynamics kind of play out on the page. Yeah, I think, yeah, this hasn't been, this has been exact opposite. And also I think, you know, Aubrey is way more patient than anyone else I've dated or anyone else I've been with too. So, she puts up with a lot of my horse shit.
I often tell young writers and young students, I'm like, never date a writer. Just don't, because no matter how good the breakup is, they will find a way to fuck with you in their writing.
Oh, yeah. I, you know, it's funny because I had, a similar conversation with some of the creative writing students that I teach. And yeah, it's like, you know, this isn't grist for mill. Don't necessarily throw yourself into this because, like, oh, the experience, because I have to live this, you know, I have to date the crazy, you know, guy or girl so I can, you know, feed this hypothetical muse or this. And it's like, no, it's going to typically just, you might get one or two decent pieces out of it, but it's just going to be more, your liver and your wallet are going to take more of a beating than necessarily, you know, the amp on which you're forging your work. So,
exactly. So wait a minute. Now, I don't want to harp too much on writing because that's not what we're about on this show, obviously. But
it's just like I realize that, like, you know, we're about 5 minutes in, and this is sounding like too much about my fucking writing.
So let me break it back then to how we operate here. I've got the burning question that is on everybody's mind for you today.
All right.
What was the first album you ever bought with your own money?
Oh, man. Vinyl, CD, or cassette?
First one. With your own money.
That would probably be a cassette copy of Def Leppard Hysteria.
Right around my period, yeah. My first was a cassette tape of Invisible Touch by Genesis.
Okay, yeah. Oh, my God. So that's basically Genesis. That was, what, 86, and Hysteria is 87?
Yep, right in the ballpark there.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was I remember I bought it at Pro Audio, Main Street, Bloomsburg. It was a place that didn't really sell records and CDs and cassettes. That wasn't, like, their main thing. It was, like, a stereo store. And basically, we went up after a Little League game, and our team got absolutely destroyed, as always. We, I think, were the epitome of the mercy rule. You know, it's kind of tough when your sponsor is cabinets. We were the cabinet pioneers. Now, horrible. But
still not as bad as Chico's Bail Bonds.
Well, see, that's still kind of cool. I mean, like, they're like the Bears. We were the cabinet pioneers. At least they were too cheap to put cabinet pioneers. So they just put pioneers on our jerseys, which was kind of nice. But in the newspaper, it was always cabinet pioneers, which, you know, probably kind of there's all kinds of probably deep psychological issues about cabinet pioneers and, you know, being, you know, husky bastard. But because I did a lot of cabinet exploring, a lot of cabinets, a lot of refrigerator exploring in my time. Still do. But Def Leppard Hysteria. That was the first one. I remember seeing the video for Women. Or Woman, and it was like a comic book, and it was like hair metal, and the vocals were like, you know, this band Queen that my dad was really into, you know, with like all these layered vocals, and I was like, oh, that's really cool, and yeah, had to have it, went up after a game, bought it, and yeah, that was the first one. Then, and right after that, I think I bought the La Bamba soundtrack.
Also good. Very good. I love Los Lobos on that. To be honest, I prefer a couple of the tracks they cover on there to Richie Valens originals.
You know, I do too. I think part of it was because, you know, at that point, that was just like the beginning of me being mistaken for a Mexican all the time. So I was like, is this what a Mexican looks like? Well, okay. You know, well, we kind of have the same nose and, you know, the hair is pretty similar. I have better sideburns, even at 13. But, you know, it was also the really cool thing is like the Los Lobos songs are really awesome. The track that I really kind of fell in love with, though, was Marshall Crenshaw's Cry, Wait, and Hope, and his cover of the Buddy Holly song. Again, set me up for a lot later on. I'm a big power pop and, you know, that nerdy singer-songwriter thing, you know, that's kind of my wheelhouse. But that version of Cry, Wait, and Hope, and just perfect.
Agreed. This is a solid soundtrack. Decent film, solid soundtrack. What was the first CD you bought? Do you remember that one?
The first CD that I bought with my own coin would be Black Sabbath Paranoid.
Very good choice.
Yeah. My first CD that I got was actually AC/DC Who Made Who. I basically conned my dad into it because, like, he, after weeks of begging for a CD player, he got me one. And I said, well, buying a CD player kind of doesn't matter if there's not a CD to play with it, right? And he's like, yeah, you're right. Damn it. You know, he bought Who Made Who. He's bought me a bunch of AC/DC now that I think about it. That's crazy. But yeah, Sabbath Paranoid was the first one I bought on my own.
Do you gravitate, you said power pop and all that. Do you gravitate toward the hair metal?
Well, no, Sabbath isn't hair metal.
No, Sabbath is not. I will never put them in hair metal. I'll be beat up on the street if I include them in hair metal.
Well, you know what? I think you know, Def Leppard kind of gets lumped into hair metal, obviously because, you know, I am their hair, let's face it. I mean, you know, you know, Joe Elliott was rocking basically a mullet for a while there. And but, you know, the thing about it, and it's kind of what I was saying before, the thing that drew me wasn't necessarily the guitars, but it was the harmonies and the audio production. I got turned on to Queen. That I think that's the ley line or the common line with a bunch of those bands and with power pop for me is, you know, I'm a sucker for harmonies. Big Star, probably one of my favorite bands outside of Replacements, which is the band. But, you know, I was listening to that. I liked the aggressive. I liked the energy. And then when I got turned on to like punk, all those things that I kind of liked or all those things I was interested in, it kind of diverged. You know, it was like the aggressive metal guitar and the crunchiness of it definitely got supplanted when I started listening to like Minor Threat, Bad Brains, Suicidal Tendencies, you know, Black Flag. And then the vocal stuff, I got really turned on to, like I said, Big Star, Teenage Fan Club. Holy cow, that the major label debut for Teenage Fan Club, Bandwagon-esque, came out the same year as Nirvana, Nevermind. And I will play that. I think that's way more interesting than Nevermind was. You know, it's just, yeah.
I could fight with you on that one, only because like Nevermind was so important to so many people like myself.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it was for me. It was like I got turned on to punk and hardcore in 89. Because my friends were into skateboarding, I was a klutz. So basically, my job was when I was hanging out with them was to handle the boombox. That was about all I was, you know, good for. And they were a little older than me, some of them. And, you know, they were listening, like I said, to things like Suicidal Tendencies. And then, like, a lot of thrash metal, too, like Anthrax and Metallica. And, you know, it was one of those things where you would just... We had two really good college stations that were both an hour apart from me. And they were playing just these... You know, they were playing punk. And they were playing, you know, these bands that kind of predated Nirvana. They were playing the Melvins and they were playing Soundgarden.
Early Soundgarden.
Yeah, like when they were still on SST, like pre-Louder Than Love. And then when Louder Than Love came out, I was like, wow, okay, this is like, you know, if our plant fronted Black Sabbath, you would have Soundgarden. So I was totally, you know, way, just mind way blown. And I remember, you know, finding like, oh, there was, they had all these albums out on Sub Pop. And Sub Pop at that time had such a cool design aesthetic. Everything kind of had, you know, it was black and white. These black and white photos were used for covers. And I remember, you know, a couple of buddies myself were just mail order crazy. So we would order things from Sub Pop and SST. And it was just, you know, it was at a time where you would just, well, or maybe College Station is playing this, but definitely you couldn't buy it at the mall. So we would just look at a mail sheet and be like, well, all right, Meat Puppets sound kind of weird. All right, why don't you get one of, you get that. I'm going to get this Afghan Whigs album. And then all of a sudden, you know, a couple months later, Nevermind came out. And yeah, I definitely don't want to say that it wasn't influential. Obviously, duh, you know. I remember when it was on 120 Minutes, the next morning, my best friend got on the bus and was like, did you see that video? And I was like, the pep rally from hell? And we're just like, yeah, it sounds, you know, I think they're on Sub Pop. And yeah, it was not that I had heard or listened to Nirvana before Nevermind or anything like that, but it was kind of like, oh, okay, they're going to be cool. They were on Sub Pop and then they were, you know, they were massive. But again, it was just, I think for me, Teenage Fan Club was, you know, this other thing that kind of happened. It was like, you know, they're European and I always have a, you know, I kind of geek out about that stuff. And yeah, I don't know.
How did it get to be that the Replacements became your number one band?
You know, I was listening to all these bands and I started reading about these bands. When I was, when I was 16, I was able to start driving up to Bloomsburg and there was this place called Muggsy's Used CDs and Records. And I used to get an allowance for the week, and I used to get lunch money for the week as well. And I realized that if I didn't eat lunch, I could pocket the lunch money and have money plus my allowance, meaning, you know, more records and CDs that I could buy. You know, I would be in there every Friday, and then sometimes it'd be Friday and Saturday, and then it became Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And, you know, it was beginning of, it was summer of 92, and he was selling this thing called the All Music Guide, which now is a website, but it was, I don't know, probably about 1,500 pages, because I kept asking him about these bands that I would hear, or maybe hear a little bit about, and he was always playing crazy, crazy good stuff, from, like, Venom to Stone Roses to My Bloody Valentine. And, you know, I always asked him, what's this? Who is this? And, you know, the one day, I think after, you know, 3 days a week of, what's this? Who is this? What label are they on? He was just like, here, here's this book. Just take it, you know, and figured like, all right, here, just, you know, just go away, you know, buy some stuff, go away. Here's this book, you know, leave me alone. It did the exact opposite. I spent that summer, I read that's, it was 1,500 or so pages. I read it cover to cover twice. I did absolutely nothing else. I basically stayed in my room and just read this thing. And it was like, that's where I found Big Star, because it was like Teenage Fan Club, Big Star. And then Big Star referenced The Replacements. And I was like, oh, they're like a punk band. Oh, they're from Minneapolis. Sounds like they hung out with Husker Du. And then I just, you know, I was really curious about them. And then I picked up Tim, which is, you know, their major label debut, because it was actually at the goddamn mall. And I was like, wow, this is crazy. So I bought that, and that was it. It was just this, it was like Tommy Ramone produced this. So it was like this weird punk thing, and it wasn't punk at all. And then lyrically, it just, you know, there was something else kind of going on. And then I was dating my first girlfriend. We went to the mall again, and we found the Pleased to Meet Me album, and she had, and I remember she bought it because she knew I was into Replacements. And we drove home, and I was like, oh my God, this is a really, really good album. I kind of need this album. And invariably, I basically conned her out of her copy of that album. I traded a copy of Alice in Chains' Jar of Flies for that album. And that was it. And then I heard Let It Be, and holy cow. I mean, as far as lyrics go, yeah, it was like poetry. It was angry, but it wasn't, you know, it was like The Beautiful Loser. The Beautiful Loser, in a way that, like, their placements, I mean, that, like, Big Star wasn't. You know, these were guys that were, they were smart enough to be, to fuck with you, but they were not over being, getting fucked over. And I think that, I don't know, that really, that spoke to me, that spoke to where I was at. You know, it spoke to, you know, an anger, but not just anger for anger's sake, something else.
Is it possible for any of us music lovers to describe or explain to somebody how we fall in love with a particular band, like what it is?
Yeah, I don't know. It took me a really long time to see that in other people. You know what I mean? Like, and I think you go so down in the rabbit hole of your own, like, you know, your own interests and your own passions that, you know, someone who connects with some music that you're totally not into. Like, I used to work at a mom and pop record store, and, you know, kids would come in and they'd be listening to Korn or Limp Bizkit, you know, and immediately I would just write them off. You know what I mean? Because it was like, I'm old. It's like, you know, this is the machine talking. You're buying something because MTV is telling you to buy it. But, you know, truth be told, I mean, you know, there was something that they connected with there. You know what I mean? It spoke to them in some way. And, you know, who am I to say what that is and what that isn't for anybody else, you know?
Yeah. 10 years later, that person may say that Korn album changed everything. Made me discover X, Y, and Z. Maybe even the band X. You never know.
Totally.
Yeah, I can't explain it. The only connection I ever find talking to people about their favorite albums or bands is that we all have the same kind of experience of this mind-numbing moment. Like,
yeah, you know, I think it's that, you know, the ability to connect. It's like any kind of art, you know, it's like any kind of calling. You know, it's like falling in love. You know, it's some kind of chemistry. You know, it's something that either circumstance, predisposition, genetics, we're just boom, you know, it happens at the right time, right place for us. And that's it. Yeah, I find it interesting that, you know, I've met a couple of people who are just like, so nonplussed about music, and it's like, how the hell can you just be like, oh, it's whatever's on the radio?
I understand completely. Yeah. Tried to introduce Frank Zappa to people before, and they're like, okay, this is all right, and I'm like, but why are you not hearing it? Can you not hear it in this track? What is going on here? And they're just like, well, it sounds weird, and I'm like, that's the point.
Which album?
A friend of mine long ago knew that I was into Frank Zappa, and they wanted to get into it a little bit, so they went out on their own independently and bought Frank Zappa versus the Mothers of Prevention. And I was like, tough choice to go with to start off with. I hate to say it.
No,
I would have said, go and get Strictly Commercial. Start there.
Well, here's, I guess my question would be to you then, like, what are your, you know, what are your go-to albums to kind of, because like for me, if you know me, you can know me by my record collection. You know, if you know what I'm spinning and there's some common language there, then we're probably going to be cool. We're probably going to be able to hang, you know, but I also use that as kind of like the dividing line for people. Like I'll put a couple things on and be like, all right, you're kind of into this. You're not, what do you mean you're not into this Big Star album? Well, all right, we're not hanging out. You know, what about for you, man? Are there any kind of like, you know, deal breakers that way? I mean, not even just for dating wise, you know, with music, but
the litmus test basically is
Yeah.
It depends on how deep I want to push the litmus test. My significant other, my wife, knows my record collection. She's grown accustomed to it. I've even turned her on to a couple of artists like Wesley Willis. But I'm trying to think, are there any albums? Because I can go really deep. I think really the litmus test for me to like really prove is Little Marky, Diary of an Unborn Child.
Oh, yeah. Wow, that is.
That's one of my litmus tests. Like, if you can make it through all of that, unironically, you and I got something to talk about, I think. We just shared something here.
Yeah, wow. Wow. See, you went with Wesley Willis. That was one of mine, actually. Daniel Johnston, or half Japanese is one, like early half Japanese, like the you know, their first album. You know, Jad Fair is his stuff is kind of, you know, I mean it's out there enough. But also I think, you know, probably like early Emperor would be in that list for me. You know, some black metal, definitely. You know, if you can be into Mayhem, and it's kind of like if you can be into Mayhem and into Wesley Willis, or at least open. I think that's the other thing, too, is, you know, it's the open mind as much as it is like, oh, yeah, I really like this, or I can really see the, you know, the value of this. Because, I, you know, you want someone to at least go be able to take that kind of journey with you, too, you know.
To be able to walk to the other side of the song and be able to go, what the hell did I just hear? Let's talk about this.
So what about like just like kind of your wheelhouse? Like if you're not into this, then wow, what are we going to talk about?
That's a really good question. I've never really thought about that. I just throw things out there and see if they stick. I think really it comes down to two genres. I'm not going to go album. I'll go genres.
All right.
One is classic country music, because so many people I meet say, oh, I hate country. And I'm like, you haven't listened to the good stuff.
Oh, man, they need to listen to Porter Wagoner's Cold Hard Facts of Life before they say anything else.
I'm like, here's a Merle Haggard album.
Oh, yeah.
Listen to Merle understood pain before postmodernists ever came up with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you are like, oh, well, country music's so simplistic, listen to Kris Kristofferson. All right, here's some Kitty Wells. So that's one genre. The other is Christmas music. It started about late 90s for me. I got sick of people saying, oh, I hate Christmas music. And I thought about it. I said, the reason you hate it is because there's only 20 songs that they play on radio and in stores. There's more out there. There has to be. And I recently had an interaction with a student because we were playing questions in class, trying to get to know each other. And I said, somebody was like, what's your favorite music? And I went, probably I'm very knowledgeable about Christmas music. And one of my students then threw the challenge down. What type? And I went, name the genre. What about you, though? What are the ones that really work for you, the wheelhouse albums?
I have a couple albums that I think, you know, and you know, it goes back to, you know, what's formative to me. I think, obviously, you know, anything Replacements do, that if you can't find something in there, in their catalog, that moves you or at least causes you to be like, okay, I get this. You know, that's an issue. I think the third Big Star record is a big one for me because it's so brooding and moody and damaged. It can be a kind of a tough listen, you know, but it's, you know, it's more of an Alex Chilton solo album sometimes, at least that's what people argue. It's whatever. It is a great album. I think those two, and also for me, yeah, I think that, you know, if we're talking genres, you know, it is... They need to be able to see hardcore, you know, beyond just the aggression of it, you know, the, you know, DC hardcore. They need to be able to appreciate that, you know. They need to be able to hear, you know, the work ethic. They need to be able to hear the politics. They need to be able to hear, you know, the passion, you know, like Revolution Summer Records, those are, you know, the Rites of Spring album, Dag Nasty, Embrace, mm-hmm. and later in Fugazi. You know, if you're not into those and you can't get into those, yeah.
It's like you say, yeah. Oh, I like the Bad Brains, but you only hear the energy. You don't realize, they switched, they switched tempos and meters here 4 times in 1 minute. You realize the depth and the speed they're working at here?
Yeah, I some people are definitely not into, you know, the dub and the Rastafari tracks that are, you know, like the I Love Jah and stuff like that. But the fact that they can do that, the fact that they had the, you know, it was all-encompassing, that part of it, that's what gets me. I think that's the thing. Like, those are such cultural blenders. DC hardcore got that in a way that I don't think a lot of other hardcore scenes or punk scenes necessarily got it, with the exception maybe of, you know, the original London scene. And half those bands didn't get it either, because they were just, too busy thinking that Sex Pistols were the punk band.
One thing I know about you, Jim, is that you are a huge vinyl collector.
Yeah,
where did the vinyl collecting start with you? Was it back when you were a teen and going to the record store every day?
You know, it was something. Yeah, I bought vinyl. Like I was saying before about going to Muggsy's. So I'd have $25, $25 all told between allowance and lunch money. About $20 actually. And I figured out that, you know, that would break down into 2 used CDs and then a bunch of like bargain vinyl, and so it was kind of a like more bang for my buck at that point. I was a big CD geek way before I was a vinyl geek. I still have probably I don't know how many thousands of CDs. It's probably, you know, it's in the neighborhood of like 15,000, you know, 20,000 CDs. Because I was also working in radio at that time, so I got a ton of CDs. But you know, vinyl was just something like I was into, and I studied jazz percussion in high school, and my drum teacher, he turned me on to jazz, really, and he gave me a stack of vinyl to listen to and to, like, here, these are things you need to hear because of the drummers are so crazy. You know, he gave me the stack that included, it was John Coltrane, a bunch of John Coltrane albums, including Coltrane Johnny Hartman, which is still probably my all-time favorite jazz album. It was Clifford Brown with Max Roach. There was Sonny Rollins in there. There was some Jazz Messengers. And, gave me a stack of vinyl. And it wasn't until, you know, a bunch of years later, one of my friends moved to Greenville, South Carolina. And I was hanging out with him. He was working at a record store called Horizon Records in Greenville, still there. One of the best record stores I've ever been in. Gene Berger, Gene Machine. I need to get up there. It's only about 3 hours from here. I need to go visit him and pay homage. But he, like, I went in, and Gene had this amazing room of vinyl. And there were things that, you know, I was like, oh, yeah, I love vinyl. There were just things I couldn't get anymore. And I remember seeing Coven's album, Witchcraft.
Ooh.
Yeah. He had that album, and he had Dennis Coffey's album that had the original Scorpio track on it.
Oh, nice.
And I just stood there, and I was like, oh. And I had just reread Lords of the Underground. So I was kind of like already in like this metal, you know, I'm never really too far from a metal mood. And I was like, oh, I really, you know, yeah, fuck it. I'm going to buy that. And then I bought, you know, Scorpio. And then it was like off to the races. Yeah. And it's just been kind of a downward spiral ever since. And that's the thing. Like, I think part of it too is, you know, it was at a time where I had, I had stopped partying nearly as much. So, like, you know, if you're partying a ton and you're, you know, and you're bombed and you're, you know, you're totally fucked up out of your gourd, the last thing you really want to do is like play with a turntable and a record. You know, you're destroying records more than you are listening to them at that point. So having CDs was like, oh yeah, I'm hammered. I'm coming home totally shithouse from the bar. I'm just going to listen to the CD versus like, I'm going to put this record on and I have to get back up. And then like by the time that I got back into vinyl, you know, I needed something else. I needed somewhere, you know, it was like right place, right time again. And I fell in love with music in even probably in a deeper way. And it definitely came back to inform just who I am. And I was like, oh yeah, this is who I am. This is what I needed to reconnect with. And that's how it's been ever since. I mean, the first thing that I do when I hit a town, when I travel, now when Aubrey and I travel, is what record stores are in town? Where can we go? Where can we go to score some vinyl? You know, that's replaced all other needs, basically. So I've just basically switched up addictions.
Forget bookstores. I'm going to the record store.
Yeah, it is. It is the, even when we moved out here to Knoxville, the majority of my move can be summed up in the amount of boxes of vinyl. Hell, I have boxes. There are still boxes that are still in the closet here. There's a bunch of boxes still in Central Illinois. And then there's a ton of boxes still in Danville. So my whole record collection isn't even complete right yet. Here in Knoxville. It's insane. It is absolutely insane, and it's kind of ridiculous.
How would you advise someone who wants to either get back into the vinyl game or wants to just do it, but they're not looking to be, say, necessarily a dealer or go to conventions and be like, yeah, I want to pay $100 for, you know. But what advice do you have for someone who just wants to get back into it? Do you, you know, go to your local Goodwill or Salvation Army and just start browsing?
Yeah, you know, it's sad, Scott, because, like, there was a time where... You know, and it wasn't even that long ago, like 3 or 4 years ago. You could go to, you know, to a Goodwill, or you could go to Salvation Army, and yeah, you could, or even like some of the record stores, and you could basically pillage like the quarter and dollar bins and get, you know, records that weren't beat the shit and that were good records. You know, now it's becoming a lot more of, you know, a picker's market. Flea markets are still a decent place for, you know, it's tougher now. I think that, especially with things like Record Store Day and major labels realizing, hey, all of a sudden these records are worth, you know, people want to buy these records. You know, they want to buy the vinyl, so they're doing all these deluxe reissues, and they're cashing in on the idea that baby boomers and, you know, kind of the Gen X, you know, we were kind of at the tail end of vinyl. You know, we either didn't own the record originally, or, you know, we sold the record because we were buying the CD. And, you know, it's like... Most of those reissues that are kind of coming out, some of them aren't even, you know, the original analog masters. They're basically taking CD masters and just transferring them to vinyl. So they're not even like the audio quality that you're necessarily looking for. And also, you know, unless you are playing, you know, on a Rega system, and, you know, you're spending, you know, you have a Macintosh tube amp and you want a wall of sound. You know, there are good cheap turntables, and you can find decent used records. You know, it's tough. And you know, if you're buying indie, obviously that's also a big help. You know, indie record stores, there are some that still have excellent quarter bins. And I'm thinking of Vintage Vinyl in St. Louis. I remember the first time I went there about 2 or 3 years ago. It was actually Billy Bragg was playing in store, which was kind of bonkers. And they would just have these bins of, like, you know, records that are worth a quarter to, you know, to a dollar. And, you know, they saw me basically just buying them by the gross, and they said, all right, here, give us $20 and fill this tote. Which was really cool. You know, and I think, I don't know if it was just because they were like, this guy has been here for hours and he's scaring the customers, or, you know, if they were just like, hey, you know, going back to, you know, to Horizon, Gene told me, you know, early on at one point, it was just, you know, yeah, when you're doing a dollar bin, you're going to have, you know, these are records that are worth anywhere between a dime to $3, but it's not worth marking down sometimes. You know, it's just easier, like, let's put it out for a buck, it's going to move. Yeah, so I think good indie record stores still get that. You just got to dig deeper and kind of look, you know, look more.
And don't believe that you're going to find necessarily the diamond at the Salvation Army or whatever, the one that's worth $100. Just go in and just whatever strikes your fancy, go for it.
Yeah, I think like, yeah, Harvey Pekar in American Splendor kind of put it right. You know, like, you know, if you're spending your weekends, you know, in thrift stores or flea markets, you know, it's kind of like the treasure of the Sierra Madre. You know, you can't necessarily think that you're going to build your record collection from, you know, like, you're going to get everything that you want for like $2 or $3, and you're going to be able to do it from Goodwill and from, you know, from flea markets. The ones that move you, the ones that are really important to you, you know, spend a couple bucks. And the ones, you know, the ones that you know you're going to play, you know, Yeah, you know, maybe buy the beater copy, but know that at some point you're gonna you may have to fork over some bread to buy like a really good copy of it. You know, I think that's you know that's a part of it too. You know, there like I have a list of records, always a list of records I'm looking for. You know, for me it's still the discovery, you know. So it's like going into a record store and seeing what it shakes out for me, versus like I need this record. Because that's easy enough to do anymore. You know, you have something like Discogs, which is a really great if you're looking to build, and you know maybe you're in a place that doesn't have an excellent you know record store because they still there's still a bunch of places that don't. You know, Discogs is a good place. You know, online, but there's something about going into a record store and you know it's like a bookstore. You know, it's community. All of a sudden, you see. You know, you see the people that you probably will be able to get on with. You'll see, you know, there's life, there's conversation. You know, there was a point where, you know, a record store was kind of like a coffee shop for me. You know, like some of the best friends I made were at a record store, were over conversations. You know, some of the best recommendations, some of the most important records I own come out of those conversations. You know, changed how. You know, turn me on to entire genres, but also change, you know, my outlook, how I was writing. So, I mean, if you're starting a collection, you know, there are a couple that you need to get that are like, I need this album. This is a really important album for me. Yeah, spend your coin, go. But go to a record store and just hang, you know, and get turned on to things that you maybe not would not necessarily buy otherwise. That's important.
Don't do it just because hipsters are doing it. Do it because you love it.
Yeah, and I think that. You know, we're kind of at a point with vinyl. You know, we're hitting a saturation point. You know, I was reading an article from The Guardian about how far pushed back the record pressing plants are right now because they're just being glutted by major labels for like Record Store Day and Black Friday, and because this is kind of like the last call. You know, one last money grab a lot of these labels have. You know, they're not putting out anything compelling or interesting or new or novel, so they are like recycling. Like, how many more times can we get someone to buy Fleetwood Mac? I don't know. Let's just put it out, you know, let's half speed master it and you know, put it out on 180 gram and add more pictures and maybe, you know, another coked out anecdote from Stevie Nicks. But you know, but you know, like there's only some more pumps left, you know, in the proverbial record geek orifice. And I think what's going to happen is, you know, the labels that were there at the beginning that kept vinyl alive, like, you know, like Merge Records, like Discord, like SST. Well, not SST because they are as much
Wrong
different.
on.
Yeah. Well, and also because, you know, as awesome as the label is what it released, they are absolutely horrible to their artists as far as like royalties. You know, just ask Bob Mould the last time he actually got paid for a Husker Du album, you know. But I think that you know it's going to be an attrition. And at some point, even like the hipster record stores, because there are a couple, you know, and you can smell them a mile away just by, you know, what they're selling and how much they're driving up prices too on used records. It's a great and horrible time to like vinyl.
Before I switch to something else, I gotta ask you though, what is one album in your collection that you are so proud of because of its either strangeness or just rarity? Like one of the crown jewels of your collection.
Boy, a couple. That's a tough one. You know, that's one thing. Like I'm, you know, I buy a ton of records, like understatement. But I'm not, you know, I don't necessarily buy for like cash value, you know what I mean? Like this is something I'm going to sell because I'm probably never gonna sell it. Probably gonna be, you know, on the streets, not with a record player, you know, with like a battery operated like Vestix, you know, bumming money to play records. As far as you know, that Witchcraft album, you know, probably ranks up there because it's a first pressing. You know, that's up there as far as rarity. And it's, I mean, it is mint. It may have been played once or twice. That's probably there. Boy, again, I don't know how rare it is or, you know, how much value it has that way. But, you know, I have my Big Star number one record is a 200 gram, you know, clear vinyl. You know, that's something that I love to death and that I play and just has I think that has crown jewel written. you know, all over for me. And also, I mean, I do have, like, I have a first pressing of Captain Beefheart Trout Mask replica. But, you know, yeah, you know, again, am I ever going to sell it? No. And, you know, it's because, like, I'm just going to hold on to it in value like it's a commemorative plate, you know? No, I don't treat my records like they're from the Franklin Mint. So, I am careful with them, but, you know, they're not investments. They're just...
I totally understand, man. There's a few albums that I just won't part with, that they're just kind of crown jewels. Like, I can't even find anyone online who has a digital copy of it, but I have it. I bought it at a dollar store years ago on a lark. The Happy Hamsters Sing Michael Jackson's Greatest Hits. that's the first album on my list to digitize when I get a converter up. But before we let you go, Jim, I got to talk to you for a moment here. I wanted to bring this up. So you mentioned radio earlier as well, and now you're back into the podcasting game, and it's coming out in just a couple of days. Tell me a little bit about what is this Citizen Lit that I keep seeing come up on the internet here? Tell me a little bit about what's the podcast going to be about?
I spent 2 years prior to coming to Knoxville working for Quiddity. I was their managing editor, and I also produced the monthly radio program that was and still is distributed through the NPR hub station in central Illinois, WUIS. And I always loved radio. Radio was kind of, before writing, I think radio was, you know, it was my passion. And married with my love of writing. I have basically spent the last 20 plus years being able to do whatever I wanted to do through the agency of writing and being in the literary scene. I've been fortunate enough to make a living at it. I'm not necessarily affluent, but, you know, I'm doing my thing. And Citizen Lit is a way to, for me, it is a way to have the literary community, to expand the conversation in the lit community. You know, there's a universe of great literary podcasts out there, and this being one of them. And when I was looking at them, you know, for me, how can we have this conversation about literature, but not necessarily just talk to writers? You know, what else is out there? I mean, that's part of it. But there's something else. I think there's something to be said about covering readings, covering festivals, talking to agents and editors, talking to bookstore owners. And, you know, the literary community is way bigger than the people who write the book or the poem. That there is something else there. You know, all these people are attracted to this world that necessarily doesn't offer very much in terms of a financial reward. It's not necessarily fame or renown. And, you know, we're all passionate about it, even if we're not writing. And I think, you know, for me, to be able to have conversations with those people and then provide a space for the conversation to extend beyond, you know, that's important. And to do it in a way that's not necessarily produced, that isn't necessarily just a long-form conversation, I think that has some value to it, too. Because I think sometimes with some podcasts, and this is just podcasts in general, you'll listen to a podcast and it doesn't sound necessarily like a conversation that you're involved in, meaning that there is a sense of privilege that you are privy to the conversation, that we're gracing you with our wisdom, but not sharing the moment with you. And those are hard to listen to. Those are borderline unlistenable, you know, because they appeal to like three people or four people. And my goal with Citizen Lit is to expand the conversation beyond just the lit community, but people who are just, you know, or at least make the lit community more accessible, you know, to not just, you know, the other people writing, but you know, the people who are reading, the people that allow us to do what we do. I think that's really at the heart of literary citizenship. And I think that's kind of at the heart of this podcast.
So letting people who are not necessarily writers, editors, or publishers, maybe just a person who really enjoys good books and wants to know, hey, I want to know more of what's out there. What are these people like? And what's this whole writing business beyond, oh, I have a book now.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because like we, you know, this summer, Aubrey and I basically, a lot of the travel that we did, and when we talk about this podcast, and we would, you know, say things about, you know, it's the literary world and talking to agents and talking about things like retreats and writing festivals Most people didn't know what the hell those things were. You know, they were interested, though. And I think that's the other part of it, is just providing a space for that, those kind of conversations. And like I said, and do it in a way that is, you know, it's not going to be a two-hour podcast. It's not necessarily going to be, you know, hell, it's not even going to be an hour podcast. And to have that access, and at least, you know, to put it out there in a way that, again, like I said, to have conversations about things like, even writers don't know as much about writing retreats as they should, you know, it's really surprising. Or at least the idea of what does publishing look like? You know, for the most part, we don't know. Where people who are readers don't know. How half the people who write don't know necessarily. To do that in a adjustable way, and hopefully, you know, turn some people on to some good reading, some good books, and also have some readings as well. Actually hearing the voice of, you know, writers and people out there, not just talking about their works, but reading their work as well.
That sounds kick-ass, Jim. I can't wait for it to drop in just a couple of days, and we'll be on the lookout for it, definitely, and what you're up to with it, because I've heard rumblings about it from the inside, from the Sundress folk, and I'll tell you, you got the fire stoked on this end, man.
Well, thank you. Again, you know, when we were looking at doing these things, having podcasts out there, like the SaftaCast, you know, lets us know that, yeah, there is a space for it, there's an audience for it, and we're just glad to be a part of the conversation.
Well, I'm glad you've been a part of this conversation, man, because you get two music geeks in a room together, and...
You know, it's funny, I'm talking about, like, how insular and how privileged, and I'm like, oh, man, have I sounded like this guy for the last hour?
We've just been too elitist, basically, like, ah, fuck these kids today. You know?
Oh, you know...
Do you have the new such-and-such album? You go to hell. Here. Happy Mondays, they blow. Here's a Doors album. It's their third album, but really it's their first.
Well, you know, it's funny because we, when I was working at a record store when High Fidelity came out, and I'd be in the store, and once a week, someone would come in and be like, "Hey, have you seen High Fidelity?" And it's just like, "Yeah," and you know what's coming, and it's like, you know, you remind me of that movie, and it's like, no. Who do I remind you of? Like, you remind me of Jack Black. And it's like, why? Because I'm fucking fat. I can't be John Cusack. I can't be the really cool guy. I have to be Jack Black because he's swearing and he's, you know, get the fuck out of my store, you know? And, but yeah, this has been cool. I'm glad able to talk records and hopefully not alienate your listeners.
It's like, can't I be the one to make lists? I can make lists too. Like, here's five songs that may or may not be about pedophilia. We're not too sure.
No, there's five album covers just in the Scorpion's back library.
Ooh, yes. Now that I think of it.
We would have someone come in looking for the original covers to the Scorpion's records. And there's one in particular called Virgin Killer. Virgin Killer is the name of the record. It was just like, you know, I'm uncomfortable talking to you. You know, I recommended eBay to him just because maybe, you know, then there would be a paper trail to, like, where he was buying things online.
You never know. He may have actually been one of the Scorpions band members. At that point, you never know. Anyway, Jim, it has been a pleasure talking to you. But before we let you go, where can the folks find you online?
Well, I am on Twitter at Who Is Mr. Jim. Mr. is spelled out, as I do not believe in brevity, obviously. And it's basically where you can find me anywhere. And that is my handle through Facebook, through Twitter, through Instagram. And also you can find me via Citizen Lit Cast. So citizenlitcast.com is the web address for Citizen Lit. It's also the Twitter handle. It's where you can find me via SoundCloud. And those are the two places to find me online. And there's enough of my nonsense out there that I can't hide anyway.
Well, hopefully some people will search you out, and hopefully some people will check you out and check out Citizen Lit, because it sounds like it's going to be great, and I can't wait to see it drop in a couple days. Jim, it has been great chatting with you, man, and getting to know each other, and I hope we get to see each other very soon in the SAFTA lands up in Tennessee.
Absolutely. We got to hit Lost and Found and Raven and, you know, maybe swap some vinyl and talk some wax.
Maybe. And if you and I ever wind up in Nashville, we must drop by Ernest Tubbs Record Shop.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I dig Nashville. The couple times I've been through it. The first time I was there, I actually was in RCA Studio B, which was pretty amazing.
Oh.
To be in the same studio where you know, like Roy Orbison recorded, that's, you know.
Exactly.
That was crazy.
So hopefully we'll get to see you soon, man. You take care now.
You too, Scott. Thanks, man.
All right. Take care.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.